At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
Hi, I'm Kristen McGlory, lifelong genius hunter. For almost a decade, I've been unearthing the recipes that have changed the way we cook. Now, on the Genius Recipe Tapes, we go behind the scenes with the geniuses themselves. This week, I'm talking with Soleil Ho and Justin Phillips, the co-hosts of the Extra Spicy podcast for the San Francisco Chronicle, where Soleil is also the restaurant critic, and Justin writes a column about race and inequality in the Bay Area. We talked about so much, from the genius cooking tricks that they have brought home from their work covering restaurants, to oddities like the one and hopefully only Rat Bar. Yes, Rat Bar. A quick warning that there is also a bit of profanity in this episode, as well as some discussion of the weightier issue of abuse in the restaurant industry in the second half of the episode. But first, here are Soleil and Justin on the most genius things that they have eaten lately.
Ooh, that's a good question.
That is a good question.
actually, you know, I think for me, it was does a drink count? Can I talk about that?
Yeah.
Cool. I went to this restaurant called Avery in San Francisco and had the non-alcoholic drink pairing. And one of the first beverages that they made for us consisted of, I want to say, what was it? It was so good. It was like sauerkraut juice. and it was just like this really smoky, salty beverage with I think a little bit of like egg foam on top as well. And they paired it with Iberico ham, and it just like made so much sense, you know, ham, sauerkraut, pork. And I was so stunned. Often I think non-alcoholic drink pairings are kind of a whatever, like sort of an afterthought at restaurants, but this one was truly genius, I thought.
And not really sweet at all, just kind of tangy, salty.
Yeah, no, there was just a little bit of sugar just to, you know, make it palatable, but and not a salt bomb, and not just tasting like the juice from the inside of a ham bag. But it was It was well balanced. Don't tell me you haven't tried to do that.
I mean, that's why I laughed, because that's relatable content right there.
to drink the ham bag juice?
We are all ham bag juice drinkers. Let's not deny it. As for me, I think, and Soleil and I used to talk about this like a lot in the beginning of the pandemic, which was like navigating emotions, being, you know, kind of like freaked out in a way that you weren't used to. And so I know a lot of our coverage, especially in print, was around like the idea of comfort foods or being able to make something that could put you at peace a little bit. And so like in the beginning for me, it was like going back to dishes that I grew up. So I grew up in Louisiana. So it's like cooking, you know, Louisiana food. And I went through this whole journey of like trying to make something like a quality pot of red beans and rice that like my dad used to make. And in this time, there's also there was also some coverage we did, at least I did, for a Creole restaurant in Oakland, where, you know, I know the chef And she launched like a YouTube channel where she would like, you know, do recipes for these dishes and like red beans and rice. And at one point she and I connected and I was like, you know, how does yours turn out like in this really great way? And she talked to me about how whenever she's cooking, she always ends up using more salt and more fat than people would expect. So I was like, oh, okay. So I would dabble with what my dad did and also increase like the amount of like pork fat that I would use and salt that I would use. Mm-hmm. And it was this like kind of fun experimentation with like how quickly I could raise my own blood pressure in my kitchen.
Do you feel like you reached your peak red no, beans?
You know, I don't think so. I feel like I don't intend to, or maybe I don't notice, but I self-sabotage. Like, if I can ever recreate, you know, what my parents make, then it makes me feel like, you know, guys, it's going to be wild to say. I'm a grown-ass adult, but it's going to make it seem like I need them less in a way. Like, I like the mm-hmm. idea that I can't make exactly what my dad would make. That makes, like, mm-hmm. going to see him and be able to eat dinner with him special. You know, so mm-hmm. maybe I'll never make one that's right on point, but I'll make a good version for myself, though. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder, too, about just all of the intangible things, you know, mental, emotional, or even just like the environment, the pot, the like those particular ingredients that, you know, are probably hanging out in your parents' mm-hmm. cabinets. Like maybe you never... Maybe you don't need to worry about it because you never will just inherently be able to exactly recreate it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing that I did miss from my parents' cabinets was consistently pulling out containers of bay leaves and seeing that they were dry and being like, why do y'all keep these?
From like 95.
Exactly. The date, the expiration date's rubbed off. Like, why y'all still got this?
Just add more. I mean, yeah. I don't know what they do, but that's probably it. What I would do.
Yeah.
Yeah. My grandmother's biscuits and gravy, I spent a lot of time when she was still alive trying to document, trying to talk to her, trying to watch her, and it never comes out the same. So I think I just have to believe that there's just something in there that like will be in our memories, but we, you know, and we can get close, but we'll never really hit it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. 100%. I mean, yeah. And so like, I don't know what you think about this, but I always think of like things that we ate when we were kids, how like, I especially miss that too, because our palates were, you know, we took everything to the extreme. If something was kind of sweet, it was crazy sweet to us. If it was sour, it was extremely sour. And, you know, if you eat something as a kid, like when you recreate it, you're going to lean into those notes that were extreme when you were a child, like especially if it's like cake or a pie or something that your grandparents used to make. Like your version might be crazy sweet because that's what you remember as a kid, and it might not have been the case. So I kind of, mm-hmm. yeah, I kind of miss that, like, I don't know. Things just seem... Oh, my God. Now I'm just talking about getting older. Things were more enjoyable when we were younger.
Well, I don't know. For me, it was the opposite.
Really?
Things were worse when I was younger because I was so picky.
No
I was
way.
So... I was such a brat. And I didn't like black pepper. I didn't like vegetables. I didn't like anything. And so everything I ate was really bland.
Oh, interesting.
How did that... And when did that change?
I think it changed with, oh my gosh, one time an aunt brought me a carton of sour cream and onion Pringles.
Whoa.
And I really loved them. And then she was like, guess what? It's onion. I was like, oh. And then that just like opened up everything for me.
So then after that, you were more open to trying all kinds of new stuff?
I think so. And I think it was just a matter of realizing that not all, you know, onions taste the same, for instance, that black pepper had a use, that there was safety outside of the zones that I had already determined.
Mm-hmm. How old were you then?
Oh my gosh. I want to say 7. Mm. Yeah. It was a lot of dark years before then.
Well, you've made up for lost time.
I think so. I mean, you know, your picky kid could become a food critic.
Yeah.
Just make sure they try some sour cream and onion Pringles, was it?
Yeah, oh my gosh. I mean, still, like, they taste like there's nothing wrong in the world.
Oh my
and
God.
Everyone is happy. you know?
I love that.
Like onion powder, garlic powder, MSG, mm-hmm. like all of those things work in tandem to make something amazing.
Were you picky, Justin?
Nah, I wasn't. I wasn't at all. I don't know. Maybe this was like mind tricks that my parents would play, but they could make something and I wouldn't know it was bad or flavorless or anything because they would be so energetic about it, right? Like, I think it was their way of like getting us to eat whatever they made, because it was always on some like, oh, you guys are going to love this. You're going to love this. And even if you weren't sure, you'd be like, okay, I'm supposed to love it, so it's good. So I think they did that for a lot of foods. I was just I was a snacky kid. I was down for whatever. I would eat what my dad ate, and my dad mm-hmm. ate everything. So.
Oh, you know what's funny? I realized too that the way Vietnamese people eat at home is so different because we don't really have set dishes. It's usually like, do you want like pho, for instance, right? It's customizable. Mm-hmm. Like, do you want this? Do you want that? Do you want some onions? Do you want cilantro? And, you know, as a kid, you just want to say no. I just want the noodles and the broth.
Yeah.
And like, there's some satisfaction in kind of knowing that your mom or your aunt or your uncle or whatever knows what you want. Mm-hmm. Too. Like, that's my order. I'm a regular at grandma's kitchen. So, and then like, you know, you have all the little dishes, the soup and the, and like meaty dishes, vegetable dishes and rice for like a normal meal. And you just pick and choose what you want. It's not like all in a pile, for instance. So I think it's a lot easier to be picky for that sort of format.
That's super interesting. Also that like, I feel like that's good for a kid to learn that they're, you know, even if it's like food choices, but their choices are respected in some way. Like as a kid, you pick up on that. Like if you have family members that understand what your preferences are, especially eating in that kind of format, it's like your feelings, I guess, are kind of validated. Like that feels like a supportive kind of space. My family was like, you know, this pot's going to be really good, so eat out that pot. But I don't like this thing. Well, then you kind of just roll with it. But
that's cute. That's so cute.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, yeah, I like both of these, you know, culinary origin stories, I guess.
Yeah, it's so different. And yet, like, you both ended up loving and appreciating all kinds of food. So, I mean, I guess that... I mean, I have a 2-year-old daughter, and I, of course, obsess about like trying to get her to enjoy as much food as quickly as possible, and she resists me at many turns. Like I was a picky kid. Like it was our destiny. I think that that I would be thinking about this stuff a lot, but it's always comforting to hear that like you can start out super picky and still, you know, come to appreciate and love and cook a range of foods. You can start out loving all foods and just keep doing it. Like, that I feel like a lot of parents could probably use that pep talk and just like wait it out a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we're both speaking as people without kids, but we certainly were kids.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know, take what we say with grains of salt.
Right, right. We don't know anything. Don't listen to us.
It is just helpful to remember like everyone has done this. Everyone has grown up and like learns to eat to some extent, you know, and you're both a testament to that. Just to go back to the sauerkraut juice thing. And by the way, I can neither confirm nor deny drinking hand packaged water. But, you know, since you both to varying degrees eat out a lot for work, or Justin, in your case, it maybe more in your previous version of your role. But mm-hmm. how often do you see things at restaurants that you then take home and change the way you cook at home?
That's a good question. I don't cook at home, though. So I feel disqualified from the question. Yeah, unfortunately, I'm always, well, not unfortunately, but like unfortunately for the context of this particular question, I do not. I don't get to cook too much. I eat out almost 6 to 7 days a week. Honestly, when I cook for myself, it's like granola and yogurt and like maybe an egg. maybe I'll smoke some fish in the back. But I've actually worked as a restaurant chef for about a decade before I had this job. And so, yeah, I mean, irrevocably, right? My mm-hmm. style of cooking at home is informed by restaurant work. I'm just more efficient. So I realized, too, like when I cook with groups, like with family, I cannot. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. I can't gel because they're also they're home cooks. I think I'm the only one who's ever worked in a restaurant kitchen. And so it can be chaotic. Mm-hmm. And I become a little dictator unfortunately.
What are the, like, I don't know if this is just completely infused into everything you do in the kitchen, but, like, are there any particular things that come to mind that you, once you saw them and incorporated them into your work in the restaurant kitchen, that was how you're going to do it from here on out at home too?
Ooh, I'm trying to think of a sexier answer than, like, all my serve safe training for, like, safety measures in the fridge. I mean, certainly, like, for instance, if I have a bunch of herbs in my fridge, one of my early jobs when I was working garmage at a restaurant, which is like salads, desserts, like that sort of thing, was herb maintenance. And so I would go into the walk-in and I would pull out the, like, yucky herbs and just, and they were all in, like, sort of containers of water just to keep them alive. And so that's how I store my herbs as a civilian, like, normal human too now. I just pick them over every day just to make sure the wilty ones are out. So they don't, like, bring down the rest of them, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is based in science. It's just, like, it's a bummer to see mushy herbs. And so maintaining that is a big part of my fridge hygiene.
Mm-hmm. And Justin, how about you in terms of, like, incorporating stuff you see in the restaurant world into your home cooking?
There's this place in on Divisadero in San Francisco called Que Fico that opened, and it was like this rustic Italian hotspot that everybody was going to and had super long lines when it first opened. But before the place opened, like, I wrote about it a lot and talked to the chef a lot. And there was, like, a day where, you know, we made, like, pasta dough together. The chef would get very granular about, like, the specifics of how the flour, how the corn was milled for the flour and things like that, and what the weather conditions were, you know, when it was created in Northern California, and just all these, like, small details. And I never understood how much how, like, that kind of specificity could end up playing into the flavor. I just thought it was always, like, before I started covering restaurants out here, I just thought that was just, like, stuff chef said that can't possibly mean anything, you know. And I kind of figured out along the way that, yeah, like, it does make a difference. Like, you know, if you're checking the pH balance of, like, the water that you're using or something, or how you have that flour stored, like, all of that does make a difference in, like, that final bite. And so I think as I explored restaurants, that was just for, like, Italian places, but there's a lot of cuisine, people who took it very serious, I took away, like, a healthy respect for what makes great food. Like, people can care deeply, and if they do it in the right way, it comes out.
Did that change how you approached anything in particular at home?
Yeah, no, I would be way more careful with how I microwaved Hot Pockets, frozen burritos. I was very, very meticulous about that. I was mm-hmm. aware how the centers might be yes. frozen blocks of ice and the edges were hot.
Yes.
You know, so, like, I'm not going to say that I took everything away, but I definitely became, you know, better at using my microwave for sure.
Yes. You incorporated maybe a flip to get the real even cooking.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I would definitely took away some tricks of the trade, and it shows in my kitchen.
Hey, it's Kristen. If you're enjoying this chat with Soleil and Justin as much as I did, head over to the Genius Recipe Tapes and hit subscribe so you don't miss out on other stories like this one. Like our recent story with Mark Matsumoto, founder of NoRecipes.com, about the early days of food blogging, the next big thing in climate-conscious farming, and Mark's one-ingredient trick that has forever changed the way that I season salmon and pretty much everything else. In the second half of this episode, we get to hear more from Soleil and Justin on the food news that is burning them up the most right now, and also Wrap Bar. Meet you back here for that. With the focus of your podcast, Extra Spicy, what is the, and I know this is changing gears, but what is the spiciest thing that has happened in food news lately that you have either recently talked about on an Extra Spicy episode or maybe you've been really wanting to talk about and haven't yet?
Justin, do you have one in mind?
Oh, man.
There's just so much.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a ton. Shit, I don't even know how to go into this. Once again, we have a... there's another toxic workplace that was exposed on the West Coast that had a chef that was leading it. Should we just dive into the details, or am I talking like in general terms for this?
I mean, it's all reported. It's all in the news.
Okay. So you got Eduardo Jordan out there in Seattle and had, you know, was it 15? I mean, I remember saying it's like more than two dozen, you know, women and former employees and employees who have spoken about the toxic workplace that he created, how he like assaulted women and or how he inappropriately touched women. And just, you know, it's pretty damn frustrating, right? Because like I didn't know, I'm not familiar with like Seattle restaurants, the Seattle food scene. But apparently this is one of those things that was like one of the worst kept secrets. And it's just like damn frustrating that, you know, we've spent years now trying to expose businesses that are run by these problematic figures and the hurt and harm that they cause. And, you know, it feels like we have these moments where everyone's like, yeah, let's get them. And then we have another story come out. It's like it shows you how deeply rooted some of these issues are and like, you know, how hard it is for people to speak out. And it's just like, it's frustrating and it makes you angry to see it. It makes you feel for the people that had to experience it and feel for the people who couldn't speak out about it. And it's like, you know, Eduardo was just being like celebrated. Hell, I included him in a story where I was talking about, you know, after the James Beard Awards, you know, Black culinary talent had cleaned up then.
That was in 2018, right?
That was in 2018. Yeah. And I had, you know, like, essentially place a little crown on Eduardo, like look at the future and this is what we're doing. And it's like, man, you know, people were talking about what he was doing then, and it's like, come on, man. Like I feel I saw this on Twitter and I kind of and I low-key agree with it, not like low-key, I agree with it, but it's like at some point, you know, men, you need to step aside, stop running kitchens, y'all need to move somewhere else and regroup and figure your shit out, because like we've been constantly covering this problem and it seems like a lot of men in this industry just aren't getting it. And it's frustrating. So
yeah, that's not like funny spicy, but it definitely is red hot.
Yeah, sorry about that. It was something that was my fault. Yeah,
no, it's interesting too, because like for a podcast, right, we are given the sort of latitude to do coverage that doesn't quite fit into the newspaper format. And yeah, we can talk a bit more topically about the things that happen. And one of the recurring conversations that we have on Extra Spicy is about the media and kind of the media's role in perpetuating the idea of the chef. And I think that to me is it speaks to the question that Justin had of just like, why does this keep happening, right? Like how every time it's like whack-a-mole. And it's because the structure, like the central structure of a media that demands heroes is still intact. You know, we fall for it. We're complicit. You know, you put the crown on Eduardo Jordan's head, and I certainly put the crown on other people's heads. And we need to stop. It's like, it's hard to stop though. It's like an addiction.
That's 100% it. And I think that's something different with Soleil and I too, because like in doing this podcast, and I'm sure Soleil, you probably were this way before, but I became this way over the last couple of years with being more introspective of, you know, especially when it comes to those moments of calling things out and being like, why is this happening? And being like, oh shit, I have a role in this. Like I'm complicit in how, and you're absolutely right. Like, you know, the machine that is food journalism definitely seeks out these, like Soleil said, these hero figures. And as much as we talk about it and, you know, show how it can be problematic and try to condemn it, it continues to happen.
And it's so interesting to think about what we in the media can be doing differently. Like, what would that look like? Would that mean focusing on the restaurant as a whole rather than the chef figure? Would that mean vetting the chefs that we're featuring more heavily? What ways could that actually play out? And also maybe for our listeners and our readers, are there ways that they can get this information that's not necessarily coming from us too, or like have an extra dose of skepticism around it?
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's a huge question. There's so much. What I can say is that I know so many colleagues across newsrooms are holding stories that they can't publish because nobody wants to come out and talk about it, right? And that's why things kind of stay at the level of Whisper Network. And that's the cool thing about alt media too. And that's also why people take to Instagram for accusations, because they don't need to go through all of that ridiculousness. That, you know, yes, for legal reasons, newsrooms have to hold themselves accountable to, you know, vetting sources and all of that. But it's not tenable for cases like this, right? Where like the person in power, you know, if you call them out, like, what do you get out of it, actually? Like, what do you get in a justice system that is so geared in favor of abusers and people who do this sort of gray area stuff that Jordan did in the past? Maybe he still does, I don't know. But I think the thing that is really frustrating, too, is, like, the nature of the NDA, right? As long as, like, people are held to these contracts that say they cannot talk badly or disparage their workplaces after they leave, then there's a lot that falls under those umbrellas, right? I think that part muzzles a ton of people in the restaurant industry in particular, but also just broadly. Another thing is, of course, like, just the economic incentives to stay quiet are just so powerful. I mean, those are root causes that Me Too did not fix, and it had no power to fix.
So do you see any... I mean, there's no silver bullet, but do you see any solutions that could be promising?
Not presently.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly like pie in the sky sort of solutions that I hope do make it into reality. Like universal basic income, for instance, would make things a lot more comfortable for people who, you know, who have to weigh the risks of leaving a job because they are being harassed, right, or abused by their boss or whatever, versus, you know, like pursuing their own health. Because there are cases in that story, right, where someone, for instance, went on a business trip with Jordan and he mistakenly, air quotes, booked a single room with one bed, and that cook could not afford to buy her own hotel room, so she just had to get in bed with him.
Oh my gosh.
And he knew that. And like these folks like him, like, know that their victims are like economically precarious, right? And if we remove that precarity, I think that would help so many people.
Ooh, so a lot needs to change.
And I'm sorry, like, this isn't necessarily about the podcast. It's just stuff that, like, Justin and I talk about all the time. But, like, we do use the podcast, I think, as an opportunity to talk about this sort of systemic stuff, even in, like, a funny or, like, you know, whatever, brusque way. It's a good outlet for that.
It's therapeutic. I think, you know, it's great that people listen to it. And, you know, from what we can tell, there are people that like it out there. But personally, like, you know, a lot of times, even before we're recording or when we record or stuff that doesn't make it into an episode, like, talking to Soleil about a lot of issues is really, us bouncing stuff off each other, I think. I don't want to speak for Soleil, but I'm assuming it's therapeutic for her as well. And it definitely is for me. But also, Soleil, should we think, is there anything that's, like, you know, lighter and spicy that, because I don't know if I derailed our direction there a minute ago, but, like, what was something that you were thinking of? Because that Eduardo stuff was just on the tip of my tongue, but what was something you were thinking of?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think we got a lot of mileage out of Rat Bar. Like,
the Rat Bar.
Which, you know, California is opening up now in the Bay Area, certainly, like, most of the restrictions are gone, and I wonder if Rat Bar is coming back. I hope it doesn't.
let's expand on Rat
Bar. Yes. All right, that's it, right? Thanks for having us. All right, so let's get out of here. I'm gonna say Rat Bar and bounce. So there was a bar. It was like a, I guess it's like a pop up. It's like a temporary thing or whatever. That used to happen every year or so in San Francisco. I can't remember the specific details, but the core of it was that people would buy tickets to go to a bar and drink around a bunch of rats that were loose, you know? And I think one of the and one of the photos too might have shown like a rat, you know, near like a cocktail glass. Like it, the imagery for it was just like, are you kidding me? It was pretty gross. And
you paid $50 per head.
That's what
to
it
get
was.
Into rat bar.
$50 per person to drink around a bunch of rats. And
I can do that for free in New York City.
Yes, I don't have to pay.
Please.
Yeah. Oh my God. And so yeah, that definitely that made LA's skin crawl for sure. Definitely made my skin crawl as well. I was also just obsessed with the idea that, you know, this was a thing that would return and people were down for it, right? Like, that's the wild part about it, is that there were people who were like, oh, yeah, yeah, no, I'm into this. I'm getting the $50 ticket. And I think, you know, writing about it, then us talking about it, then us, you know, kind of being like, this is ridiculous, probably drove business to them. So I'm sure it'll return at some point.
Wow. Well, I do appreciate you, Justin, also just saying like what was like really actually burning you up in the moment. So glad to go down that path. Also glad to know about Rat Bar, and like, I'm not going to be able to forget that.
Oh man.
I will be Googling that and wondering why is it that a lot of businesses, will not be returning that we would really like to be returning, and yet Rat Bar lives on.
Yeah.
Well, just like rats, after, you know, you drop a nuke, they're still around. That and the cockroaches.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you imagine buying, like paying $50 to go to this? Oh, wait, never mind. You don't have to wear masks anymore. I was about to say, like, just the idea of drinking next to a rat while also having to put on a mask at some point just sounds like some end of the world type horror movie scenario. Just sounds disgusting.
You can only take off your mask if you're drinking a cocktail or kissing a rat.
You have to kiss the rats. How did I know you were going to say kissing a rat? I mean, I feel like this might be the best, like the most appropriate microcosm of a Extra Spicy podcast. The last like 5 to 7 minutes of, you know, talking about like the systemic problems in the restaurant industry, and then a couple minutes later being like, hey, so what about that rat bar? You remember that? You want to kiss a rat?
Yeah, you want to kiss a rat on the face?
Thanks for listening. And my thanks to Soleil Ho and Justin Phillips, the hosts of the podcast Extra Spicy. Our show is put together by Coral Lee with support from Emily Hanham. If you have a genius recipe to share, maybe from your favorite restaurant, I would always love to hear from you at genius@food52.com. And if you like the Genius Recipe Tapes, which is mostly rat-free, do take a sec to rate us, leave us a review, and subscribe if you haven't already. All of it helps. Talk to you soon.